The Michigan State University campus here in East Lansing is often described as one of the most beautiful in America. This week, one unique campus flower is drawing particular attention. The so-called corpse flower has the stench of a rotting corpse. It is also, I'm told, the largest flower in the world. One of the few in the United States is here at MSU. People are coming from around the region here to see this flower in bloom. They only have a couple of days to enjoy that and the stench. Joining us today on Current State to tell us more about the mysterious corpse flower, Frank Tolusky, professor of plant biology and curator of the Plant Biology Conservatory. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you.
Along with Peter Carrington, assistant curator. Hi,
Thank
Peter.
You.
What can you tell us about the status of the corpse flower? I know everybody's keeping a real close watch on when this blooms. Has it bloomed?
Not yet. As of this morning, the main, what we call the spathe, that's kind of a, think of it as a petal, but it's not a true petal that surrounds the flower, has not peeled away from the spathex.
Okay.
The spathex is the part that actually contains the flowers, the male and female flowers. We're hoping that this will happen shortly, maybe within the next few days. I'm hoping maybe by Wednesday. But it seems to be taking its time. It's very hard to predict exactly when this was open. But for those who are interested in following us, we do have a Facebook page, the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden. It's a page, you don't have to be a member of Facebook. It is a public page, and we are posting updates up there daily, sometimes hourly, to keep people informed about its status.
And Peter Carrington, this creates quite a stir. Talk to us about that. People come from all over to witness the corpse flower.
It's quite an unusual event, and in any given decade, there are very few flowers from this plant around the world outside of its natural habitat on the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. And so getting a chance to actually lay eyes on one of these things when it's really open, really at anthesis, is really quite a memorable event.
Is it the largest flower in the world?
Well, technically, if you get into the language of it, it's technically the largest unbranched inflorescence in the world. We have this giant thing. And superficially, of course, to any civilian, you could say that looks like a single flower. But there are actually several hundred male flowers and several hundred female flowers in this one structure that looks like a colossal, you know, 6.5 foot tall flower.
And so visually, this sounds pretty dramatic. What color is it, Frank?
Well, when the spathe opens up, it'll be a maroon-red color, and a lot of people, I think correctly so, I think that it resembles that of rotting flesh, because the smell that it'll produce will also be mimicking that that wonderful odor.
How many corpse flowers are there in the country?
I don't know exactly how many. I know there's one at the National Botanical Garden in Washington, D.C. Brooklyn Botanical Garden has one. The Franklin Conservatory in Columbus, Ohio. I understand there's two at Selby Botanical Garden in Sarasota, Florida. And one of those may be also getting ready to bloom. I just sent an email to them to confirm that. And if it is, we're going to try to do a pollen exchange so that maybe we can actually cross-pollinate the flowers.
There's some, and that would achieve what?
Oh, that would help to produce fertilized seeds so that we could actually produce plants from seeds that would rather through the sexual production of the flower as opposed to asexual production from having the corm divide down below ground.
Okay. We're talking with Frank Tolusky and Peter Carrington of the MSU Department of Plant Biology. We're talking about the corpse flower, which is just about to bloom. It's renowned for its stench and for its size. Why are they so rare, Peter?
Well, they never have. I mean, the species actually evolved on the island of Sumatra, and so there really isn't. It was never common, even in its home range. And so the fact that it takes so long, I mean, it's not too hard to get a hold of one of these corms. They could be the size of a peanut or so. But they have to grow up to almost 30 pounds of corm, tuber, in order to be large enough to have the critical mass necessary to flower. So that happens relatively rarely. At least outside of its home range. But like I say, it was never common, even in its home range on Sumatra.
So it's academic interest in this thing that really drives it. It's not a popular appeal, or
I think there is a certain amount of popular appeal to it. Again, as you stated before, in terms of being the largest unbracketed inflorescence, and the fact that you have this smell that's unique. It's insect pollinated, and that smell attracts things that are attracted to carrion, as opposed to honeybees or bees that are attracted to sweet scents. And I think the really important thing for us as curatorial folks here at MSU. And at a university that has such a strong plant biology emphasis and program through a number of departments and colleges, that this is an important outreach element, that we can actually grab a person's imagination, grab family imagination, small children and adults as well, about the wonders of the plant kingdom and to get them curious about plants. And as we move more and more into a virtual environment and video games and urban environments where plants like this are even becoming rarer to exposure, that this is a great opportunity to expose people to the wonder of the plant kingdom.
When was the last time the corpse flower bloomed?
Well, this particular plant bloomed in 2010, but we had had the plant for roughly 20-some years by that point.
And before that? It's unpredictable. The locusts or the cicadas
A matter of clockwork. It's a matter of how long it takes to achieve the critical mass necessary to make a flower. So under excellent conditions, such as our plant has received in the conservatory, we've gotten it to flower here today, but that's only 4 years after the last time it flowered. Mm. It's probably not that often except under the finest conditions even in the wild. And so many people take decades before this thing gets large enough to flower.
Do you let members of the public come and witness this plant?
We have the conservatory open just for this event. The public can come during any of the weekdays between 10 o'clock and 2 in the afternoon. If it's still relevant by this weekend, we would offer it hours from 1 to 4 in the afternoon on the weekend days.
And remind us where the Plant Biology Conservatory is, Frank.
The Plant Biology Conservatory is at the corner of Farm Lane and Wilson Roads, and there's a small road drive as you're heading east on Wilson Road, just east of Farm Lane, called Science Drive, and there's an A-frame sign pointing to the corpse flower with the times on it. We suggest that people coming to campus during the work week, park either in the Wharton Center parking ramp, public parking area, or in the public parking lot over by Horticulture near the 4-H Children's Garden off of Bogue Street, and then walk over to there. Because as you know, parking on campus can be quite difficult. After 6 p.m. or certainly on weekends, parking is free. And when this flower does bloom, and we'll put the, as we say, we're following on our Facebook page with the social media. When it does bloom, I'd like to open it up so that people who are working until 5 o'clock have an opportunity to come and see it as well. So the day that we announce that it's actually in bloom, I'm going to open it up till 7 p.m. so that people can actually see it if they can't get out of work until 5.
You know, the day that happens, let us know.
And absolutely.
We'll spread the word. Yeah. As well.
I'd like to give a little shout out to Jan Sirens, who's our botanical gardens technician over in plant biology, and she really works wonders with plants. And so it's to her credit that she's gotten this thing to bloom within 4 years of each other. And I think that, we're not sure if it's a horticultural record or not. We're going to be checking with some of our colleagues at other institutions, but to get this thing to bloom in such a short period of time, so blooming in 2000, blooming again in 2014. It's a remarkable feat, and she's to be congratulated.
That requires some particular kind of nutrition then, or what?
Well, she fertilizes it. She waters it. She makes sure that the leaf, when the single leaf comes up in those years when it's not flowering, has plenty of opportunity to photosynthesize and build up that critical mass, as Peter calls it, that photosynthate, the starch, for it to be able to flower.
How close do you have to get to this thing to savor the stench of the corpse flower?
Well, I expect that when it's fully open, you won't have to get all that close to it. It is in a room, more or less, and I don't think there'll be anywhere in the room that you can hide your olfactory senses from this once it gets actually cooking, but that isn't just quite yet.
Do botanists, horticulturalists, take plants from one part of the world and actively try to propagate them? I'm talking about in the wild, not in academic settings, but in the wild, in other parts of the world. Does that happen, Frank?
I guess it depends on your definition of the wild. Certainly in forestry and in horticulture and in agriculture, we do this all the time. You know, we grow pineapples in Hawaii when they're native to South America. We grow coffee in South America when it's native to Africa. We grow citrus in America where it's native to Asia.
What about non-agricultural crops?
Yeah, in terms of non-agricultural, I don't know of too many where we deliberately introduce them into the wild. There's been accidental introductions with invasive species, which cause a different set of problems for us ecologically. So we think of loosestrife or garlic mustard or buckthorn here in Michigan. Unfortunately, those non-native plants are very successful at colonizing and then outcompeting some of our native species. But to do it, we don't really do that much. I think if you go back in time, and certainly Professor Beal's time, when they were interested in reforestation and trying to reestablish forests in Michigan, he was looking at both native and non-native species. He experimented with, for instance, Norway spruce and with Scots pine. But, you know, again, in plantations, we see some of those, but mostly going back to using native species, white pine, red pine, that's native to the state.
We were talking about this before we came on air, but talk to us, Peter, about the redwood story that
there
we
is
got
a,
into.
There is a species called a dawn redwood in the genus Metasequoia that has been known for centuries as fossils. So it was astounding in 1940, a scientist from the Central Forestry Institute of China, Dr. Fan, while walking down a footpath that connected Hubei to Sichuan Province, found a very large, unusual-looking conifer next to the road. But because the dawn redwood loses its leaves as though it were a deciduous tree in the winter, it was several years before the tree was fully described, and a couple of years after that before any seeds were actually brought out of China. And the very first batch of seeds came out by diplomatic courier to the U.S. Embassy, which I believe was in Shanghai at that time, and then delivered to Dr. Merrill at the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard. And then he took those seeds and their subsequent seedlings and distributed them to 77 botanical institutions literally around the world. And that's how we come to know that even though its present-day wild distribution was so tiny, it's only two small valleys in southwestern China, that this species is still able to be grown in a wide selection of the available climates on planet Earth today.
Amazing. Talking about propagation here. We only knew about this species through fossils previously to that, and it was rediscovered in 1940.
Now, another view to this question is that our role as botanists might be a little different in the future, because as global warming tends to restrict species in places where the climate, they could be reintroduced in other places that are becoming more and more accessible to that species. And so we may see more of this as an effort to protect species in the long term.
Interesting. We'll keep an eye on it. Frank Tolusky is a professor of plant biology and curator of the Plant Biology Conservatory, along with Peter Carrington, assistant curator. We're keeping an eye on the corpse flower here at Michigan State University. Frank and Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.